poor Angus was, because he only had an hour for the whole session, but you have an hour and a half. So we're going to hand you over to our newly confirmed president, Andrew McGowan, who's going to chair this session and bring our conference to a close at the end. Thank you, Andrew. Mr. President.
I thought it was people your age who became presidents, Fergus, rather than young men like me. It's my great pleasure to introduce the last speaker at our conference, the Reverend Doug Gay. Doug is lecturer in theology and religious studies in the School of Critical Studies in the University of Glasgow, and also principal of Trinity College, Glasgow. Doug's a Church of Scotland minister, but has also worked in the United Reformed Church in England. He's a hymn writer with significant interest in liturgy. He's even been a columnist for the Times. But it's his academic interest that I suppose we're particularly concerned with here. And he has two main areas in which he's worked. The first is ecclesiology, where he sought to look at the interaction between Reformed theology, emerging church theology, and in a sense how all that relates to ecumenism and mission. But he's also engaged significantly in political theology. Some interesting articles on Gordon Brown's contribution to theology, politics, and Christianity. But more particularly, he's been interested recently in the relationship between theology, politics, and independence, which, of course, is the theme of our conference. And so he comes with the title, Is a Christian Vision of Scottish Identity Viable in the Early 21st Century? And just before he comes, let's pray. Our most gracious and sovereign Lord, we thank you for your goodness to us, for the way in which you have blessed and enriched our lives. And we thank you for this opportunity to come together and to think about the things of the faith, to have our minds stretched and challenged, and to have our hearts warmed as we worship, as we share fellowship, and as we enter into your most holy presence. Grant, O God, that you would be with Doug as he comes to speak to us. Give him clarity of thought and expression, and help us as we engage with this paper to learn and take us forward, Lord. For we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.
I need to raise this a little bit due to my great height. Someone said to me recently, I think it might have been Jamie Grant, I'm not sure, what are you doing at the SETS conference? And he assures me he was meaning what was the title of my paper, but I was tempted to answer trying to rehabilitate myself. My colleagues certainly seem to think I'm an evangelical, although that's not always a complimentary word in their vocabulary. I want to begin by expressing my appreciation to SETS for the invitation to speak, and also by saying how much I have appreciated hearing the other speakers, Jamie, warm and generous and insightful, David, rigorous and compelling as always, and Dewey, I was enormously moved by your Finlayson lecture last night, and Angus, your perspective this morning gave us lots to reflect on, and also the questions and comments from the floor. And it's been especially helpful to me because the topic of this conference, as Andy has said, is very close to the theme of my own research at the moment. So I'm in the early stages of writing a book on the theological ethics of nationalism. And it's currently entitled Honey from the Lion, hence the slide here. It's due to be published next year. So So, given my title, my hope is that Tate and Lyle are going to agree to the use of the image on the front cover, but I'm not completely sure that'll happen. We'll have to wait and see. Anyway, in my paper today, I want to share some of the trajectories from that work and fly a few kites. It's work in progress, and to make some suggestions, and all this in the anticipation of your feedback and your questions, helping me to develop and refine my own thinking. A couple of people here have heard some of this, elements of some of this before, so forgive me, it's been in the works for a little while. Out of the strong came forth sweetness, is Tate and Lyle's take on and take from Judges chapter 14. And I have stuck to it, if you'll excuse the pun, because I am interested in how sweetness comes forth from strength. And also because the wider Samson narratives themselves raise interesting and troubling questions about the relationships between Israelites and Philistines. Why could you not get a wife from amongst your own people? It is the Lord's will and promise that the people of God take possession of a land flowing with milk and honey. In the Song of the Psalmist, in the 19th Psalm, we hear a celebration of a politics in which the righteous judgments and ordinances of God are like the drippings of the honeycomb, but even sweeter. When the lion is of the tribe of Judah and the root of David, we might imagine with C.S. Lewis that even though his roar was deafening, his breath was still honeyed. And yet even this lion, when we look for him in Revelation 5, morphs into the form of the slain lamb. How much more then when the lion rampant or lion's passant represent the power of an earthly state, might they be in need of breaking open in order to release sweetness? We're talking, of course, about the problem in political theology of the relationship between power and goodness, between power and virtue. In the second chapter of the Westminster Confession, we are reminded that God has all life, glory, goodness, blessedness in and of himself. He alone is the fountain of all being, of whom, through whom, and to whom are all things, and has most sovereign dominion over them. But while power and goodness are indivisibly united in the life and work of the Holy Trinity, and by extension within the city of God, the same is not true of the earthly city, where the possibility of a godly commonwealth is constantly threatened by the love of power, by Augustine's libido dominandi, by its effects and consequences. In this paper, I want to try to redeem the term nationalism as part of a viable vision of Scottish identity. And I argue that to redeem it, we will need to break it open in the hope that a broken and contrite nationalism God will not despise, but will bless. Nationalism, not only, but primarily Scottish nationalism, is now centre stage in British politics and seems likely to remain so until the independence referendum is held in 2013 or 2014, depending on whose will prevails. I want to begin with a bit of what Stanley Hauerwas calls swamp clearing. There is a degree of willful stupidity which afflicts debates around nationalism. Yes, there are nationalists currently in power in Holyrood, but there are also nationalists in power at Westminster. And critics of explicit nationalism, such as that of the SNP or of Plaid, very often struggle to acknowledge their own British nationalism. And when this is not just partisan dissembling, it's usually an example of what the political theorist Michael Billig calls banal nationalism, a kind of nationalism which people simply assume and therefore become blind to because they've become habituated to its constructions and conventions in their daily lives. There is a lovely sermon, and I don't know if you know this, Dewey, by a Hispanic theologian called Justo Gonzalez, a sermon on the day of Pentecost. Has anyone come across this? And Justo Gonzalez preaches this sermon, and in it he says, you know, the thing about the day of Pentecost was if you were in the dominant language group, you didn't get the miracle. You had to turn to somebody in a minority and have them tell you that the miracle had happened, because you were used to hearing the gospel preached in your own language all the time. I think that's an extraordinary insight there, and is relevant to Michael Billig's comment about banal nationalism. We need to stop pretending that nationalism is something a bit like an accent, something that other people have and I don't. And instead, as the young people say, we need to fess up to our own nationalisms. And this confession needs to be both an admission and a repentance. But it also needs to be effective, I think, at a theoretical level. And I want to recommend a book to you. It's the best recent book on theories of nationalism, which I know of, and it was produced in Scotland, written by an American academic, an anthropologist who works at Edinburgh University. Jonathan Hearn's book, published in 2006, called Rethinking Nationalism. I also strongly recommend his earlier book, Claiming Scotland, if anyone has read that. And he's very interested in religious and theological themes and has some very interesting stuff about covenanting and the disruption in that book as well, Claiming Scotland. So this is Jonathan Hearn's. And I just want to walk you through some key passages in Hearn's book here, to give you a sense of where he's going in his rethinking of nationalism. He says that he looks on the politics of stable democratic regimes as what he calls the routinization rather than the overcoming of nationalism. He argues that in stable democratic regimes, this process of nationalism is very deeply embedded in civil society and in electoral systems. And it's not simply an elite or a state-led process. It's part of the normal functioning of democratic regimes. This is not how many of us normally think about nationalism, and I think it's important. He says that liberal democracies do not so much transcend that nationalism as domesticate it, routinizing its dynamic by channeling it through core political institutions. And I love this next sentence because it chimed. I'd already got my own title about breaking open lions. On the one hand, nationalism is seriously altered by this context, defanged for the most part, and rendered less dangerous. But on the other hand, it's an indispensable aspect of the state's ongoing need for legitimacy and inevitable competition between social groups to define the wider society of which they are members. So he says nationalism is a basic part of how relatively stable democracies legitimate and re-legitimate themselves. He goes on to quote from Beetham's work on legitimation, which, you know, he says it involves voting, conformity to rules and laws, and then justification of those rules and laws in terms of shared beliefs and values and standards. What's at stake, he says, is contending visions of how a population within a given territory should be governed. And such visions are normally underwritten by a certain conception of the population's common identity embodied in what Roger Smith has called stories of peoplehood. Moving on to the last quote, he says, political parties compete to win votes, and they do this by making claims to represent the entire national population. In this way, far from transcending nationalism, normal democratic party politics keeps national identity on a constant slow boil. Nationalism is an essential resource for the maintenance of legitimacy in democratic regimes. Now, I think I commend the whole of Hearn's book, and I know I've walked you through some of my own notes on it here, but I think Hearn's work is very important because I think it's inviting us to think about nationalism in a way which is very different from the rather polarised and demonised way that many of us think about nationalism and that is sometimes presented in the to and fro of political debate. And Hearn's, I think, significantly as an anthropologist, is giving a rather different perspective on this and saying that we can see this as something which is rather basic to how our societies function in their normal course. And he, again, comes back to Billig's work on banal nationalism in this book. and says that his larger point is similar to Hearn's own point, that nationalism is not just residual background noise. It's a key legitimising resource that can be activated and brought into the foreground. So sometimes it's quiet in the background, and then sometimes you turn the volume up. Think of the Falklands War, for example, and British nationalism. You can quite consciously turn the volume up if you need to mobilise people in various times, if you need to dig for victory, if you need to send a task force to the Falklands, etc. So nationalism for Hearn's is not a strange and exotic creature. It is part of the normal functioning of democratic regimes. Above all, and here is where we get back to the initial questions about power and virtue, it's a key part of how regimes normally legitimise themselves. And with that idea of legitimacy, we are brought firmly into the territory of theology, political theology, of dogmatics and ethics. Taking a metaphor from card games, for Christians, there are certain key stories which must always trump all other stories. The narratives of creation and redemption are always trumps within Christian political theology. They always lead or even force the conclusions that we should only, for example, ever make a singular use of the language of race. We are all, as Hamish Henderson says, the bairns of Adam, and as C.S. Lewis says, the daughters of Eve. The imago Dei given in creation undercuts and overcomes all other distinctions. And this image, as it is restored and renewed in redemption, leads also to an insistence on the other great singular of one church, entry into which is by virtue of one baptism, so that for Christian theology, water is always thicker than blood. Here we have to do with what has recently been engaging the interest of Zizek and Badiou and Agamben and others in their readings of Paul. The capacity of these particular narrative traditions of Judaism and Christianity to fund and to fashion universal claims. Attempts by these thinkers in some way to move beyond some of the impasses of postmodernity. Claims of common humanity and common salvation which trump all attempts to place one class or one gender or one ethnicity above others. And I want to claim that this same capacity to fund universal claims can be found in the detail of the Genesis narratives. And other people have walked this ground before me already in the last 24 hours. In the early chapters of Genesis, we are faced with two great sendings. On the one hand, the one human race is sent by God to fill the earth. We are sent into Eden to fill it. And after the fall, human beings are sent out of the garden to make their home east of Eden. And these two sendings suggest two truths about how we belong in the world. The first sending forth to fill the world affirms the value of every place within creation. As the Puritans used to say, every place is immediate unto God. There are no parts of the world which are in principle God forsaken. Not even England. The second sending, the sending out of the garden, when humans are forced to improvise home east of Eden, away from the presence of God, is a sending out into a world marked by death and violence and insecurity. And every place in this scenario is equally alienated from the presence of God. Edwin Muir famously spoke of how Eden shut the gate that's everywhere and nowhere. There are no parts of the world which escape the flood. There are no parts of the world which are in principle closer to God than others, not even Scotland. We have then a double theological verdict applied to every place on earth where people make their homes. Another universal claim that every society, every nationality, every place is both affirmed and judged, is a place of both vocation and alienation. And if we stay within Genesis, we come to what I do believe is a pivotal story for nationalism of Babel and its tower in Genesis chapter 11. Now, I was intrigued to hear this reading coming from a much earlier source, as Dewey told us last night, than I had found it before. But conventionally read in terms of a divine curse and a fall from unity, in The Meaning of the City, the French theologian Jacques Ellul suggests an alternative reading, in which what is cursed is the imperialistic, even fascistic project of Ein Volk, Eine Sprache, God's way of frustrating and resisting this demonic form of unity is through the blessings of Babel, the gifts of linguistic and cultural diversity. And in Ellul's reading, these become resources which enable a resistance to imperialism. Implied here is a new mandate of stewardship, a kind of doubling of the creation mandate. A stewardship of cultural diversity, a mandate which is affirmed by the Holy Spirit at Pentecost, when that Spirit is revealed as the Spirit of translation, giving birth to a church whose Catholicity transcends cultural difference without abolishing it. This is a providential mandate whose value within history is dramatized and celebrated by the great vision of Revelation, in which heaven itself displays every tribe and language and people. And here I think we're beginning to edge closer to the potential for some kind of nationalism to be a legitimate and even necessary part of the human vocation. We approach this if we begin to think the idea of cultural diversity all over the world is something which God sees and about which God says it is good. Its goodness echoes the goodness of the whole creation in the beginning, but it also has the character of a kind of providential goodness, something which is provided by God, given into the human historical future in the face of human evil to defend human flourishing, which is given in particular as a resource to protect the weak and those who are most likely to become victims of empire. And such a narrative dogmatics implies a narrative ethics. If we follow this trajectory of reading scripture, the universal scope of this blessing implies an ethic of equal regard, an ethic of neighbourliness which binds us into loving our neighbour's culture and language and place as we love our own. There is a pluralism here which is saved from being relativistic by the earlier double judgment I spoke of, the sense that all cultures take their place on the earth in relation to both a divine affirmation and a divine judgment. And my other great book recommendation, if you've not come across it before, a book which has been one of the most important things I've read in the last 10 years, Laman Sani's superb book, Translating the Message, which I think is hugely significant for theologians and biblical scholars across the piece. And Sani writes, Christianity is first and foremost a pluralist religion. As Paul affirmed, there is no respect of persons with God, and nothing in itself is unclean. The positive sides of these statements are equally valid. All persons are precious in God's sight, and all things indeed are pure. In the same fashion, no one is the exclusive or normative pattern for anyone else, and no one culture can be God's favourite. My stewardship of my culture, therefore, involves both celebration and penitence. And I should also expect that from you in your stewardship of your culture. Furthermore, I am my brother's and sister's keeper. I am challenged not to do violence to your culture just because it is different to mine. As Dewey might say, I am charged to keep, not to castrate your culture. So far, then, I have been trying to explore and sketch out a broad Christian perspective on human cultural diversity. And I've been trying to do this using the resources of a biblical imaginary. The difficulties come when we try to exercise this biblical imagination within particular contexts. In particular, things get difficult when we have to move from these rather fuzzy ideas about cultural identity and bring them into dialogue with modern ideas of the nation and the state. My church officer in London used to say I was a thirsty preacher. Here we must confront the toxic history of nationalism and the role of a renegade biblical imaginary in constructing this. Adrian Hastings, in his important study of the construction of nationhood, ethnicity, religion, and nationalism, highlights the crucial role played by the Bible in the emergence of European national identities. In particular, he points to the Old Testament stories of Israel as a single nation existing within a land with a particular capital, religion, and monarchy. A common thread, he says, across many early nationalisms is the way in which nations imagined themselves to have inherited Israel's election as the chosen people. And the form this took in Scotland and elsewhere would be laughable often if its effects had not proved so lethal in constructing myths of national superiority which could be harnessed to imperial ambitions. The most profound dilemma and problem associated with nationalism has to do with the fundamental political question of how to relate government and territory, with questions, therefore, of sovereignty and borders. The idea of the nation-state has emerged in the modern era as the dominant global model for organising political life. Stanley Hauerwas has argued that this is where we find one of the most profound deficits at the heart of liberal political theory. Liberal political theory, he says, based in universalist notions of human rights and voluntarist understandings of social contract, has particular problems in accounting for borders, in positing land and territory as organising principles, in giving, therefore, an adequate account of the nation-state. In the aftermath of World War I, the American President Woodrow Wilson famously tried to set out an account of liberal democracy which balanced the right to national self-determination with safeguards to individual liberties within sovereign independent states. Wilson's vision, which called nation-states to work together peacefully in a League of Nations, was desperately over-optimistic, and it foundered in the face of a new wave of fascistic and imperialistic nationalisms, which led the world within a generation into a Second World War. And the battle against these nationalisms, in particular the versions developed in Germany, Italy, Spain, and Japan, had a profound effect on the reputation of nationalism. Out of a generation sickened by the carnage and division of a Second World War, many people, and not least many Christian people, emerged with a deep conviction that nationalism was the root of a great evil and needed to be opposed root and branch. And that position is still very common today. There are, however, three problems, major problems, I think, with that distaste. The trouble was, when it came to facing the task of post-war reconstruction, the idea of the nation-state remained really the only game in town, the only plausible candidate on which patterns of governance could be based. So the new international organisation was called the United Nations, and its charter embodied the principle of self-determination in Article 1. The other massive development which challenged the distaste, or challenges the distaste for nationalism in the post-war period, is that nationalism became a crucial vehicle for those arguing and working for decolonisation. And here perhaps we see echoes of the Babel argument we made earlier, and I'm aware of the points that were made in last night's lecture about the difficulties associated with this as well. But nationalism, which was an ideology which could be used to oppose imperialism and to assert the rights of those who had been colonised to throw off the yoke of the oppressor. It also became a vehicle for validating and reasserting the value of languages, cultures and traditions which had been despised and suppressed under imperial rule. Nationalism therefore became a crucial part of the struggle for freedom, first for the countries of the global south, and then in the years before and after 1989 for the peoples of Central and Eastern Europe. The third problem with Western liberal and leftist disdain for nationalism harks back to Michael Billig's idea mentioned at the beginning of banal nationalism, which is to say that much of the time critics of nationalism were and are deeply hypocritical, in my view. They assume and ignore their own banal nationalism, and indeed, which is the point, fail to recognise it as nationalism at all, while condemning the bad nationalism of others who are aspiring to the same kind of political settlements they already enjoy. The question we face, though, is whether Christian theology can approve this rehabilitation of nationalism, and on what terms. In The Desire of Nations, Oliver O'Donovan, unlike Hauerwas, who just gives up on this task, does try to help us think theologically about the state. And in his chapter on the obedience of rulers, In his chapter on the obedience of rulers, he argues that the provisional character of the state is revealed in a Christological understanding of trumps and triumphs. The most truly Christian state, he says, understands itself most thoroughly as secular. It makes the confession of Christ's victory and accepts the relegation of its own authority. The only corresponding service the church can render to this passing authority is to help it make this act of self-denying recognition, urge this on it, and share with it the tasks of practical deliberation and policy which seek to embody and implement it. The church has to instruct it in the ways of the humble state. Now, I want to draw my thoughts towards a conclusion by reflecting on what this might mean for a viable Christian vision of national identity. Following O'Donovan here, and in the spirit of the sixth of my own church's Articles Declaratory, can we see what the kirking of a parliament must involve substantially? The church, as it confesses its own brokenness, must call for a breaking of the nationalism by which the state seeks to legitimate itself. In making its own confession, it must also call for a national metanoia. For the power of nationalism to be sweetened, there must be a turning from the three great evils of absolutism, imperialism, and essentialism. That means the nation must be, in the language of the Barman Confession, under God and under the lordship of Jesus Christ. It must renounce domination and practice recognition. And it must renounce a biological nationalism based on the jus sanguinis, or law of the blood, in favour of a habitat-based nationalism based solely on the jus solis, on the law of territory. Even when it has done that, O'Donovan's tasks of practical deliberation and policy still remain. Should the goal for us be a re-covenanted, that's for you, Jamie, parliamentary union, which seeks to give fuller recognition and respect to its constituent nations? Or should it be a social union made up of a confederation between those parts of the UK which wish to be independent? Judgments as to which of these is a viable Christian vision of Scottish identity will involve attending to the tests Jamie Grant set for us in his opening lecture, asking what best reflects the kingdom of God and serves the mission of God. It will involve considering the sober reassessment of the relationship between church and state urged on us by David Ferguson. It will involve us in weighing how we can hear Dewey's call to resist the Babel syndrome which has characterised English nationalism and do justice to the stewardship of Scottish national identity which has been entrusted to us. For my part, I am convinced that independence for Scotland within a reworked social union of the Isles and within the European Union offers the most promising way forward. The version of the nationalist project currently represented by the SNP is already broken in most of the right places. It does turn away from these three great evils, and it offers compelling opportunities in our time to turn towards a number of great goods which reflect, I think, what Jamie urged on us in terms of our thoughts about the kingdom of God. So here are seven civic virtues and public goods which I hope independence could help us to move towards. Humility. Finding our place in the world. It is time to give up the pretensions of empire. Another text which has been enormously important to me, although not having the Gaelic, I had to read it in translation, is Fergus MacKinlay's wonderful poem, The Midge, which if you've not read, was a poem which I go back to. I read every year, and a poem which changed my life and shaped much of my theology as well. An extraordinary, Derek Thompson, who died recently, called it the most original and exciting sustained long poem to be published in Gaelic in the 20th century. And I urge that on you. McKinley says, "I am small and like small things, the buried seed that splits the stone, the little country, the little language." Peace. We have a once-in-a-generation opportunity to reject and perhaps fatally undermine the Trident program of nuclear weapons. Not everyone will agree with me on that, I'm aware. Equity. Seems to me that currently, and despite what's been said about how different Scotland is from England, I believe there is a stronger social justice tradition in Scotland, and that this is the best chance we have of embracing a social democratic project of reducing inequality within Scotland in the next 20 years. Hospitality. My wife works with asylum seekers here in Glasgow. I think we have the opportunity to create a different culture of welcome and hospitality in a Scotland which is still welcoming new recruits to its workforce. Mutuality. Rethinking the whole concept of the national interest, of being part of an interdependent world, affirming that in relation to independence within Europe, which was one of the crucial moves that Scottish nationalists made in the last 20 or 30 years. The only kind of nationalism worth having is simultaneously internationalist, involves recognition of the other. And I think this would be profoundly good for England also. I remember Jock Steen saying to me when I was 18 years old and thinking about these things for the first time, that he would not be a nationalist if he did not also believe this would also be good for England. Subsidiarity. A drive for participation and for the renewal of democracy related to decisions being made at appropriate levels within our society. And then finally, I think we have another once-in-a-generation chance to end nuclear power in Scotland, to rethink our energy policy, to be good stewards of the gifts God has given us of wind, and sea and rain and sun, the gifts we often complain about, of land to grow timber. I know not everyone will agree with me on these, but I'm giving you my own thoughts about viable visions. My claim here, then, is that a theological construal of nationalism along the lines I've suggested can lead a case for independence as a liberating option for Scotland and for England. One in which Scotland's lion rampant is not a predatory and devouring beast, but a nationalism which is broken in the right places, in which we, like Samson, can get honey from the lion, and about which we can tell this theopolitical riddle: out of the strong came something sweet, out of the eater came something to eat. Thank you very much.
Doug, thank you very much indeed for that paper, wide-ranging. Someone said, I think yesterday, that he hoped that there were some people who were giving serious thought to what kinds of principles ought to be applied if Scotland becomes an independent country. And I'm glad that you and others are engaged in that work. Although I do think there's a certain lack of entrepreneurial vision in what you say. I would have been more inclined to contact the sugar company and say, I'm going to put your logo on the front of my book if you pay me a significant sum of money. This is free advertising. So instead of begging them to give you permission, I mean, refocus.
It's a very optimistic view of my sales figures, Andy.
And we have 15 minutes for questions and discussion before we break for lunch. So I'll put that back up for you. But this session was scheduled 11 till 1:30. 11 till 12:30.
No, it's 13 till 1. 9:30.
Oh, sorry. My apologies. In which case, you have lots of time.
Well, we have lots of time, I mean. Sure.
Doug, is there a danger in your vision of nationalism that it becomes an idol that seeks to replace Christ, who is the desire of nations, as Oliver O'Donovan has pointed out very well?
Well, I'm very puzzled why you should ask that, because it seems to me I took great care to suggest that the whole absolutizing of the nation was one of the things that specifically had to be turned away from, you know. And that, this is going to be a danger, as in many areas of life.
Excuse me, Doug. This has been recorded. Could you use the
microphone? I'll use the microphone. As in many areas of life, repentance is not just a once and for all thing. It's a constant vigilance against certain dangers. And I think this is where the practices of the church, if we understand the political significance of our own confession of Jesus as Lord, in the way that Karl Barth and others taught us to through the Barman Declaration, then we are going to, instructing the church, it has a slightly Oliver ring to it. I'm not sure how much the state wants to be instructed by the church in contemporary Scotland, but I think there is something in what he says, you know, that the mutual obligations of Article 6 maybe are slightly less provocative. In other words, that we, in our constant attempt to confess the lordship of Christ within our own lives and within the life of the church, have to try and bear witness to that always within the life of the nation as well. And so one of the things that we're constantly vigilant against is any idea that there is an absolutizing of national identity, that there is a displacing of the lordship of Christ. And it's interesting, certainly, you know, in the work of someone like Hauerwas, there would be very strong arguments suggesting that he believes, for many North American Christians in his own context, that exactly that idolatry of the nation takes place within American civil religion. And so this is a real and present danger, but I hope that I made very clear that if you are going to call yourself, as I would, a Christian nationalist, then that there is a certain breaking of nationalism that's involved, and that's one of the key things that has to be rejected.
Jamie. Doug, thank you for a stimulating paper. I was particularly impressed by the way you were able to incorporate comment in all of the papers from yesterday, so it smacks of some late night work finishing off your paper last night, but I was impressed with that. Doug, just as you were asking me, I just want to flip the coin in the question that you posed to me yesterday. So, you know, the danger of, I think you used the term Kantian rather than Marxist, internationalizing of concepts of identity and culture. Is there a danger in adopting this same generic principle of microscoping culture, and we just go down and down into ever more narrowly defined cultural groups, if you see what I mean? So, you know, first an independent Scotland, but then what about the Gaelic speakers if they want, you know, an independent Gaelic speaking Highlands and Island? You know, do you know what I mean? Is there a danger in this direction as well?
I'm sure there is a danger, but there's also, I think, something unavoidable about that. I think there is a constant negotiation, and this is where I think what O'Donovan says about this becomes an issue of judgment and of practical reasoning and deliberation. Another really good book, I think, that's come out in the last couple of years is Luke Bretherton's book on Christianity and Contemporary Politics, and I recommend that very highly. And Luke's Aristotelian vision about politics as a debate about goods in common, you know, and I think that there are no divinely ordained answers, as you pointed out, to these questions. These are political questions, and we have to discuss them in relation to goods in common. So I think that nation states certainly are provisional and relative constructions. Human beings make them, and they can adapt and change them. They can opt to enter into a union, which enlarges, a parliamentary union, which enlarges the state or they can opt, I would suggest, to secede from that union and to become independent, but stay within other unions or alter the terms of the union that they're part of. And again, Shetland, Cornwall, those are conversations that would have to be had in future. And I don't think they should just be used as a reductio ad absurdum for that. I think the point that I was making, though, about in terms of our core confession of Christ as Lord, our core Christian teachings about the unity of humankind in creation and redemption, those are overarching narratives and claims which we make about human identity, which counter the idea of this microscoping that you're talking about. So there's, and the Catholicity of the Church as well is another key confession that we make, I think, which is constantly involving this mutual recognition, this celebration of diversity. So it's an ethic of equal regard, I think, which emerges from this way of narrating human diversity. The dogmatics implies an ethics in a suitably Barthian way. Sorry, was somebody... And then Howard at the back, yeah.
Doug, I was going to ask about the church in relation to all of this. Once or twice yesterday, there was a kind of a disjunction between the church as the church and individual Christians as individual Christians. And I guess I'm wanting to ask your perception of where the church in Scotland is to authentically declare this message to the nation. The three areas of brokenness, where the nation needs to be broken, is that exemplified in the life of the Christian community as a community in Scotland? The seven areas of public good, are these areas where the Christian community is serving the nation to authentically say to the nation, this is what you should be like? Or are we dependent upon groups of individual Christians who share this brokenness and strength to convey that message prophetically to the nation? Do you see what...
Yeah, and actually your question makes a lot of points very, very eloquently. It isn't so much it needs to be heard as much as to be answered, I think. I mean, I think the situation is very mixed. I think the Church of Scotland has to be very, to speak for my own denomination, has to be very sober in the way that David suggested, I think, about its own reach and influence in contemporary Scotland. I've been on the Economics Commission, which is reporting to the General Assembly. And what was interesting about that was that major figures within Scottish civil society agreed to come on the commission. And that was Jeremy Peat and John McFall and others. And a sign, Graham Smith from the Scottish TUC, a sign of the regard they have. And one of the things, there's a kind of pathos to some of that, actually, in that sometimes I think they want the church to be more than it seems capable of being at the moment within Scottish public life. And I think when I did my own doctoral work, one of the things that I looked at was the Bailey Commission, which was possibly the last great occasion, I think, in which the Church of Scotland really spoke into the public life of Scotland. And one of the things that struck me was that Bailey and others, I think, were deeply concerned about that toxic legacy of John White in the 20s, and that Bailey spent the 30s preparing himself for that role in lots of different ways. G.H. Oldham and other was gathering groups on both sides of the Atlantic and across Europe to try and rethink Christian social concern. The Oxford Conference in 1937 gathered T.S. Eliot and Mannheim and Tawney and all these other people, and they did the theological work. And then when the Second World War asked the questions, I think they were able to give a theological response. And one of the things that worries me, and I said to you yesterday, one of the things that worries me about the preoccupation, to sometimes to the exclusion of all other things, of evangelicals in Scotland at the moment over the sexuality questions, is that history is asking us a range of questions at the moment, and we're in danger, I think, of not being theologically prepared to address them. And we have to do the work in terms of public theology and reflection on the public good. And again, the sort of things that were being said last night by Dewey, you know, we have to do this work. There's an urgent need, I think, for a theology of nationalism, a theology which addresses these questions. And it may look very different from the one that I'm trying to offer at the moment. But what I think would be tragic in its own way would be if what you implied is if the moment comes and we haven't done the work and we're kind of mute within this public conversation. I think that would be a failure of what God is calling to us to in this moment of history. Howard, and then...
I don't want to change the subject if you think this is a fruitful land rather at the moment, but my question is this. We agree probably there is such a thing as institutional or structural sin and sinfulness, which people who are not Christians would also agree. Presumably, therefore, there is institutional and structural righteousness and justice. So in that framework, I draw our attention to the public goods you're listing here, which seem to me to be obviously goods. Would these not be aims that we must have for Scotland, whether it is independent or the status quo or some other political system? And would you say that these public goods can be more easily or better achieved under independence or without it? I'm trying to see the relevance of this to our decisions about the kind of nation status we want for the future. But it's the importance of these public goods that I'm really concerned with.
And that's very helpful, Howard. And I think one of my chief points is that I think in two of these issues, which I feel very passionately about, opposition to Trident and opposition to the development of civil nuclear power more generally as well, I think we have a once-in-a-generation opportunity to do something about those within Scotland. I think that in relation to finding our place in the world and taking... thinking about ourselves to scale and in ways that I think reflect on decisions that have been taken in recent years to go on various kinds of foreign adventures and get involved in foreign wars. I think the first issue of humility is extremely important, and there is an opportunity, I think, to break a certain militarised understanding of Britishness, which has been hugely powerful over the last centuries. And that's why Scottish nationalism is extremely dangerous at the moment to the British establishment. There is a real breaking of things which have been very powerful and which have shaped world history and not just our own history, which is at stake here. Can you imagine, for example, the idea of an English nuclear deterrent? Just say it a few times and you realise how much work the word British does to legitimise and reinforce something like that. So I think my point is, in relation to equity as well, it seems to me, after the disillusionment, for those of us who I would see myself somewhere on the left, for those of us on the left, the disillusionment of 13 years of Labour government in which our society is no more equal than, you know, that's still a dream for me. That's still something I want to put energy into and imagination into, that we can be a more equal society than we are at the moment. I think the work that Wilkinson and Pickett have done, the Spirit Level book, has renewed that, the sense of the goods at stake in that. And again, I believe that a Scotland where, despite all the phony wars that go on between them, the SNP, Labour, Lib Dems and the Greens would have a huge majority in relation to social policy. We have the best chance in a generation of doing that compared to trying to compete with the interests and the voting habits of the south of England. I could go through them all. You know, for me, exactly what you're saying is part of my practical deliberation. And equally, for me, in that sense, I'm a soft nationalist in that if I felt that these were going in the wrong direction on all of these indicators, and it was not going to take us towards the kind of public goods and virtues that I'm talking about, I think I would have real hesitation about saying that the project of independence must be pushed through at all costs. That would not be something that I would support.
Does Alex Salmond exemplify the humble leader in Scotland, the quintessential state? Or to put it another way, can we have the appropriate Christian vision but find it almost impossible to apply? And I think you have a very interesting vision.
Yeah, I knew somebody was going to ask that the minute I put humility first. I think you can make a distinction between... I know lots of people who are Christian ministers who I think are annoyous, bumptious characters in person. But actually, I think they've got a pretty sound idea of the end of the day, of the basics of the gospel, and that they are sinners who need to fall on the mercy and grace of God in the big picture. That they do know what the gospel is, even though I find them very annoying sometimes. And I may well be one of them for other people. And I would want to suggest the same about Alec. I think that a lot of people find him annoying and bumptious. But if you look at what he says about these key issues and the kind of civic nationalism that he, as a politician and as a thinker, endorses, I think his nationalism is broken in the right places.
Sorry. See, I think that my concern is that there's a pride in this vision. It's not that these things are not good things. The problem is this is about how we get to them. And there's a danger that we try to replace Christ with a sort of social democratic Scottish nationalism. And that's what concerns me. That the place to start has to be...
Tell me why it concerns you. I don't understand why it concerns you.
Because I don't see the secular political discourse around nationalism in Scotland, which would all sign up to this, as being able to deliver these things, because it doesn't deal with the fundamental problem, which is the pride of the human heart. And that's my concern.
Yeah. I think I didn't see that I thought... I'm something of a Mennonite in lots of ways. David Reimer's not here anymore, but I've spent enough time working on Hauerwas and Yoder. And I'm enough of a Calvinist to be profoundly sceptical about political processes. On the other hand, I'm enough of a Calvinist to believe that God calls us to work and to imagine and to argue for kingdom values in public life. There was yourself and then David.
Yeah. I just wanted a postscript on a comment about Alex Salmond at the 2011 Scottish Church Song General Assembly. He quoted, and those of you who know your history will know what he was referring to, he said, "I'm God's silly vassal." So maybe, you know, with all the caveats about where he's at spiritually and so on, plus the fact I know anecdotally he's got a sister who's an evangelical Christian, maybe we should just pray for the man. You know, that's scriptural, isn't it?
Yeah. I hadn't heard that quote, so that's brilliant. Thank you for it. I must track that down. Thank you. David.
Very rich and bold paper. It'll take me some time to digest all that and process it, but...
Bold, well, was this like a yes minister word? Courageous paper, Doug.
Courageous.
Sorry.
A couple of thoughts. It seems to me that there's a strong and implicit argument for an international ecumenism in your paper that might need to be developed if the church is to be truly Catholic and is to contribute to the detoxifying of certain forms of nationalism. And one of the problems of post-Reformation churches is that they have tended to be coextensive with nation-states, and perhaps we've not fully recognised problems that has generated. And in a post-Barmendick situation, we perhaps have to consider more carefully the theological imperative of ecumenism, which has gone somewhat out of fashion I would say. A second thought is whether actually the argument might lead to something like Devo Plus rather than independence. I mean, it seems to me there's a certain tension in withdrawing from one political union in order to play a part in a wider political union. After all, our links with the English-speaking peoples of the United Kingdom are historically stronger than our links with the peoples of Europe, although these, of course, are important links as well. So I could equally imagine somebody using your premises to reach conclusions that look more like Devo Plus. And I think that's where I would go, partly because I'm not as confident as you are that this is a good thing for England. I would worry about the emergence of a certain type of English nationalism that might be very problematic. There's very little prospect of another Labour majority in Westminster if independence comes to Scotland, at least in the foreseeable future. And it's not at all obvious to me that if Scotland goes in that direction, it's going to be a very good thing for England, leaving aside what we then have to say about Wales and Northern Ireland. So, I mean, just a few thoughts.
I mean, my biggest concern actually is to do with the impact this has on Northern Ireland. You know, if you ask me what my biggest political concern is, I think there are big issues waiting there. But I want to say yes and no to the second point that you made. In theory, absolutely, in a sense, the point I'm making about practical reasoning, about a provisional understanding of these things, absolutely, this can be an argument for Devo Plus, Devo Max, just as much. I think one of the problems, the reasons why I think that we can't... we shouldn't go in that direction, is because, or we should press further, you know. I would settle for that rather than nothing. It's because I think the British state has been so inflexible about reforming itself, and I think you can see this in a number of areas. I think the way in which the Tories outmaneuvered the Lib Dems into a fiasco on the proportional representation. Now, the reason that Murdo was sitting here at all in Scotland is because of proportional representation in relation to the Scottish Parliament. I mean, I think it's a scandal that all the people who vote Conservative in Scotland at a general election end up with virtually no representation at Westminster. So the iniquities have first passed the post, and all the people who have supported that, I think, out of a naked sense of self-interest, it's one to me of one of the lowest ethical points in our whole political system is the major party's continuing defence of first past the post. So I think that inflexibility, the failure to reform the House of Lords in any meaningful way, I think you could have constructed a different kind of political settlement over the last 20 years. It was the great failure of New Labour as well when they were in power. One of the many great failures, but another of their great failures was the failure to reform the House of Lords along... And to be honest, the only thing that will save the Union now is some kind of thoroughgoing federalism. And it seems to me nobody in UK politics really has the appetite for that anymore. And without that, then we will end in a situation where Scotland is continually vulnerable to Essex Man and Daily Mail values in terms of what happens to large areas of our public life, and also in which we can be dragged into wars, which the vast majority of the Scottish population, I think, don't support. So I think that we're past Devo Plus and Devo Max being enough, personally. On your first point about international ecumenism, I completely agree with that, and I've written a little bit about that in my little book on the church, about... I couldn't get to the conference here last year, but I think the whole theme of evangelicals and ecumenism is a really important one. And I think the continuing balkanisation of the Christian church is a huge... I was speaking to David Miller earlier on and in his office, and Leslie Newbiggins, The Gospel and the Pluralist Society, was sitting on his desk. And those were my first 10 weeks of theological lectures at Glasgow. Leslie was the Alexander Robertson lecturer when I was there. And the first 10 weeks of my theology teaching were what was published as the Gospel in the Pluralist Society. And I regard that as an enormous privilege. And that was the beginning, I think, of me moving from a rather arrogant evangelical disdain for ecumenism to, I think, learning in some humility from him about the importance of the connection between ecumenism and mission, not least, which he's done so much, I think, to teach us about. So absolutely endorse your first point.
I would, in a way, just like to follow that up as someone who's been born and bred and worked in England for 40 years, just to ask you to consider the potentially disastrous effect on England, parts of England, of Scottish independence. You refer, it's interesting, when you refer to England, you refer to the South almost all the time, which, and indeed, there are many people, I think, in the South who would quite like to dump the rest of England, as well as, have to dump Scotland. But, and I link that with the thought that, to me, many of these highly laudable public goods require a level of international action now, quite unlike the past. I mean, the globalization, if governments fragment, unless we create at a continental level really powerful political institutions that could have their own effect on nationalism of a very perverse kind, government, the real purpose of government to secure justice will be unachievable, I think, because the financial and economic forces that are so dominant in the world today, we need powerful government in order to control them. And powerful government is not fragmented government.
Well, I think there was some real tensions in what you just said. You know, the irony for us at the moment, for example, is that being part of the union means that we are victims of an anti-European mentality, which is driving lots of the behaviour of our government at Westminster. And so, in a sense, our desire to play a more positive role in the European project, to emphasise that interdependence, is being frustrated by the right wing of the Conservative Party and their Eurosceptic project. And so Scotland is being held hostage yet again by that group on an issue where we need to be more interdependent and more international. The vision that certainly the SNP have and the one that I would endorse is very much an interdependent, internationalist vision. I think this question, though, and it would be really interesting, because we've got more time, it would be just interesting here. Don't feel you've got to ask me a question. Feel free to make a comment. But this question of is it good for England, I think, is a really important question. And clearly, Alex Salmond pulled a few chains when he said in a speech in London recently, this might reanimate English traditions of radicalism and dissent in this area. And here's what I think is that imperialism is not only bad for those who end up being what do you call the subject, it's also bad for the imperialist. My little parable of this is, I'm a huge fan of political news programmes, and if you watch Newsnight, okay, if you watch Newsnight in Kent, okay, what happens is Jeremy Paxman appears, or Kirsty Work at the beginning of the programme, and the programme runs for an hour, and then it stops. If you watch Newsnight in Scotland, then what happens is Jeremy appears at the beginning, or Kirsty appears at the beginning, and then you go for half an hour, and then the theme music changes, and Gordon Brewer comes in with Newsnight Scotland. But what's interesting about that is in Scotland, I see that change taking place. In England, I'm oblivious to it. And it seems to me to be an interesting little parable of the way in which an imperialistic mentality works. People universalise their own perspective. I mean, I have to stop myself throwing things at the radio in the morning because my wife listens to Radio 4, so we're lying in bed, and the number of times, you know, you could get into the hundreds of times that the BBC routinely refers to things as national when they're devolved. You know, it's not bad for my blood pressure listening to it, really. You know, but it gets to the point where it's almost no point in keeping score anymore. And it's there's something about the arrogance and just the inability to see and to notice and to understand what's going on, because you're the majority speaker, you don't get the miracle. But you just don't see what's going on. And how is England ever going to find its metanoia from within that unless it has to take responsibility for its own identity? And that's why I think, I don't think it's going to be easy for England, because I think, interestingly, if you look at the research that's been done on Muslims in Scotland are very happy. Researchers at Glasgow University are very happy and comfortable in the survey work that's been done to identify with Scottish nationalism, many of them. They don't feel it's a threat. Ask the same question in England, and Muslims are very unhappy to relate to Englishness as opposed to Britishness. Britishness feels like a much safer identity for them than English does. So there's something about that has to be defanged in Jonathan Hearn's work. But whose work is that? You know, I don't think that there's very... I'm speaking at a conference in Manchester in 2 or 3 weeks' time, another conference on this same issue. I don't think that English people are very ready to listen to the Scots and the Welsh. Many people have been trying to do this for a long time. I think they need to take responsibility, in a sense, for their own structural sin in this area. And they need to seek the healing of their own... The stewardship of their own identity, which God has entrusted to them. And I think that's a profoundly spiritual task for English people. And I wonder whether, apart from Scottish independence, whether they will take that on. And that's a problem for English political theologians as well, that I think they're not calling people to that in the way that they should be. Alistair then.
I guess my problem is at that point, because the language game talks about different people to justify there being different people, which is slightly problematic. If these are goods, and we could have a political argument about one or two of them, but broadly speaking, fine, then is there not a certain amount of saying, well, if we split up from you, we can get what we want, rather than having to do the difficult thing of interdependence, which is about not getting completely what you want when you share sovereignty or whatever else it is. The same argument could be used in a European scheme. If we have more subsidiarity, we could do more of these things that maybe Europe doesn't want to do. So happens that Europe's more left-leaning and we suit certain politics at the moment, but that could change, has changed over the time. Scotland, we assume, is better on its own because it's more left-leaning, but as was pointed out yesterday, that's only a 50-year history of Scotland being more left-leaning. 50 years ago, you get a Conservative majority in Scotland. So I just wonder how much of this is being shaped because we really want to be really Labour socialist and we can't get that unless we get rid of you, which is not actually the principles of some of these things. For instance, if the ending nuclear power is a good thing to do, then what good does it do not to have any in our backyard, but it's in Cumbria? The mesh and the interdependence is there and needs to be dealt with, and simply saying they need to work that out for themselves, is that not, in a sense... works only if you start off with saying, well, we are we, and that's the border, and...
But in an asymmetric union and in a constitutional settlement where we don't have fair voting systems, then I think that you know, there are lots of problems around trying to do that kind of negotiating and influencing. I think we've been trying to do that for a long time. I think that, you know, some of these are judgment calls. You know, I'm not, and for me, they're judgment calls. In a sense, what I've tried to do, partly because I get called a practical theologian, And I think that there should be a moment within practical theology when you take the risk of betting on certain kinds of, that's the wrong word for this gathering, isn't it? Investing yourself in certain, supporting certain kinds of practices, visions of transformed practice. You know, so I do that not to try and impose, but in a sense almost to be slightly more vulnerable and take a risk and say, what if this? Because I think it's good for generating debate. I think I've already answered the question about England in some ways in that I think that they... So long as you can put... I mean, one of the reasons why Trident's such a problem, and I was involved... there's an academic at St Andrews University who I heard speaking on this recently, is a nuclear specialist. And this is his main area of expertise. And he reckons that from discussions with top MOD officials that they do not believe there is anywhere else within the UK apart from Holy Loch. And, of course, they've spent billions and billions in providing the facilities at Faslane. You know, enormous, I mean, unbelievable amounts of money have been poured into building the infrastructure, new roads over the hill and everything like that. And there does not appear to be anywhere else where they believe, partly because it would be too close to a large civilian population. I'm thinking, I live in Glasgow. But where they could put these... So people are talking about having the British nuclear deterrent having to be positioned with the French or with the US fleet somewhere, which, of course, would become an absurdity in terms of an independent nuclear deterrent. There are big issues here. But I think people haven't taken the responsibility for them, partly because you can stick it up in the Holy Loch, and it's Armando Iannucci has a lovely column where he suggests a fleet of nuclear submarines anchored at Cheltenham.
Just in a sense, add a little bit to the whole issue of question of peace.
I can't quite hear you, so
let me just try and talk a bit louder. I think from the point of view of peace and mission, the war on terror has probably done more damage to Christian mission in the Muslim world than anything else in the last 15 years or so. And Britain has been fully committed to that, in a sense, fully committed on our behalf in Wales and Scotland, who might have preferred not to be fully committed. And I think that... from the point of view of mission, to be able to distance ourselves from the war on terror might not be a bad idea, because there's a tremendous lot of work to be done to rebuild, if you like, trust amongst Muslim people that the gospel of Christ can even be heard at all.
Jason, then Jamie.
Doug, I see what you're saying here. I'm a little fearful that the union of a theological rationale or a biblical rationale for national independence can be transferred to other institutions, organizations, bodies, whatever, very easily. So, for example, the church, or as I alluded to last night, the division of races, what have you. It seems that those, you know, the arguments from Babel, etc., can become slightly slippery in that way. Do you follow me? What would you say to a church institution? I mean, what if, you know, in the current crisis in the C of S and the tribalism that has been described about the church in the Church of Scotland and the church in Scotland, do we say to factions or subgroups, yes, independence is better because of all of these goods that can come from it? You know, so a biblical or a theological rationale seems to me to be slightly slippery.
Just say one more sentence about why. Because?
Because it can be transferred very easily to other bodies. I mean,
New Testament has so much to say, and we dealt with this last year in this conference, regarding unity. And Jamie's, I think, directives yesterday were very instructive and clear that the trajectory is toward inclusion and unity. And the view of Revelation is that maybe those nations and tongues don't cease, but they are together. So certainly from a Christian point of view, I would find these kinds of arguments troubling. And if a biblical rationale for something like national independence, maybe it holds. But I'm just afraid that it holds in a slightly unnerving sort of way, that it could be easily transferred to church, or it could be transferred to other spheres.
Alan Bozak, South African liberation theologian, we spoke in Edinburgh back in the 1980s, spoke about the point at which the state of Romans 13 becomes the beast of Revelation 13. And for me, this is one of the reasons for adopting this imagery, and it's why I was also intrigued to find it in Jonathan Hearn's about the need to defang nationalism. Once you start to deal with issues of power in almost every area of human life, whether it's in the church or in the state, you have to reckon with power. And if you pretend that you don't have to, you know, and the confession that Jesus is Lord is takes us immediately into questions of power and authority. You are in dangerous territory. And that's why you need this sense of vigilance, this sense of repentance, this sense also of distance to some extent between church and state. On the other hand, I think that Oliver O'Donovan's I think astonishing work in The Desire of the Nations, a book which, you know, I think we're still digesting the significance of some of the things he's said, and a book where I think he has his own extended meditation on the complex legacy of Christendom, and at what point, in a sense, do you step forward and endorse certain political arrangements as the church, and in what sense do you just try and keep your distance? Because on the one hand there's the danger of quietism, on the other hand there's the danger of syncretism or being assimilated to a particular ideology. These are dangerous questions, but that's all we get is to be part of a church where life within the church is often dangerous and vulnerable, and to be part of a world which is a dangerous and vulnerable place as well. And that's why we need to be able to think and pray and worship together, and have gatherings like this where we try and listen to one another and say, is there a word from the Lord?
I think this will have to be the last question. Did you say there was someone else?
I think Jamie at the back.
I'm happy to see it if we want to eat lunch. It's a brief one. Doug, again, I resonate with an awful lot of what you're saying. Two words that we hear very often from your lips, I think. We simply don't know what an independent Scotland might look like. So, on a practical level, one of the great criticisms of the Act of Union was that there was no dissolution clause. Once we were in the Union, there was no way out. So would it not be wise in that set of circumstances that if there is an act of independence, that it should include some possibility to reintegrate with the Union if we feel ultimately that is a more just framework than the one that we entered into?
I hear what you're saying. In a sense, you don't... Sorry? No, it is a small question. I think it's an easy one to answer in the sense that you need a get-out clause if you're in something. But if you're out of something, in a sense, you are free as a sovereign nation to join and unite with anybody else you want to. Whether the people you've left would then want you back is another question.
Thank you. Well, first of all, join with me in thanking...